I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about things that are small, creepy, and crawly, landscape insects. With spring in full swing, we'll talk about which insects are good for the environment and the life that grows within it, and which ones may present problems. My guests are Cliff Sadoff, a professor of entomology at Purdue University, and Joellen Meyer-Sharp, who's your garden author, garden magazine editor, and columnist. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. And Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about landscape insects. And we're going to try to talk about the ones that can be beneficial and the ones that occasionally can be harmful. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, my guests are two veterans of the show, starting with Cliff Sadoff, who's a professor of entomology at Purdue University, and my former colleague at the Indianapolis Star, Joellen Meyer-Sharp, who is now a Hoosier Garden author, garden magazine editor, and columnist. Welcome back, both of you.
Thank you, John. Good to be here.
Thanks, John.
It's good to have you both here. Well, we probably ought to start out, I will say most of these things that are in any way gardening related is I'll do my standard disclaimer when we do shows like this, that I have always had some sort of learning block when it comes to these things. So I say this to our listeners, if you are afraid about calling in with a stupid question that would embarrass you, just send it by Facebook or email or whatever. I'm your guy today. I will ask it because you cannot be less informed about this subject than I am. For whatever reason, it just does not process. Why don't we start with, Cliff, a definition of what is a landscape insect?
A landscape insect would be one that feeds on a plant that you would like to keep looking nice or providing you shade in your garden.
Okay. And can you give me some examples of landscape insects?
Well, I also should include vegetables and flower pests as well. So a good example might be, say, Japanese beetles. You might see them feeding on roses. But right now, probably the biggest landscape insect you're going to see is the eastern tent caterpillar. So you might have noticed some flowering crabapple trees with some white tents or nests in the center of them as you drive along the highway. That's probably the most obvious one you'll see today, this afternoon.
Okay. And the premise of this show, Joellen, is that because we've gotten so much attention on, you know, the emerald ash borer and all of that, the harmful insects to certain types of vegetation and plant life, that we shouldn't assume that all insects are. What are some that actually, you know, are helpful?
Well, bees are helpful. Okay. Bees are very helpful. Pollinating insects are helpful. There are other kinds of beetles and other flying insects, flies, that will kill undesirable bugs. There are lady beetles. The larvae of lady beetles like to eat aphids, for instance. So there are lots of good bugs. There's actually more good bugs. I think it's something like 2% of the bugs in the world are considered like bad bugs. And all the other bugs are good because they either eat the bad bugs or because they pollinate or have other some role that they play in our ecology.
Cliff, in that 2%, what are the ones that Hoosiers have to worry about? Well, I'm assuming not all 2% of the ones in the world are here. That would be a misfortune of biblical proportions, I would guess.
A misfortune for you, but job security for me. But actually, I don't even have to joke around. Right now, we have an insect here of cataclysmic proportions called the emerald ash borer. Mm-hmm. And this insect is feeding on ash trees throughout the Indianapolis area and through many parts of the state of Indiana.
And how did it get here?
It arrived here on solid wood packing material sometime in the early 1990s in Detroit.
Okay.
And which means it hitchhiked on a slab of wood under the bark.
And that's the reason, like in my neighborhood, you know, we went through this thing where trees would have either ribbons or paint of some kind on them. And it was a sign that they'd been hit by the emerald ash borer. What trees have been affected by that, and you know, basically, what's the carnage right now?
Okay, well, right now, the emerald ash borer attacks only ash trees. Mm-hmm. Okay, and in the 80s, about one out of every three trees that was planted was an ash tree. So there were many developments that were just all ash trees in the streets, and these beetles will kill every single tree that's not treated. Okay, and so right now, in certain communities, parts of Indianapolis, we may have 70% of the trees dead. In other parts of Indianapolis, we might have 80% of them alive. Okay, so we have a big mixed bag.
And is the worry that, is there any reason to fear that they'd move to other trees other than ash trees?
There's no real worry. They have been very specific. There has been a new report that they will feed on the white fringe tree. But that's in southwestern Ohio is where they found it. But as far as we know, it's just on ash trees.
Okay.
And there are 7 billion ash trees in North America, most of which are susceptible. And there's something along the lines of 7 or 8 million ash trees in the state of Indiana.
Is there anything that can be done, you know, after the emerald ash borer has attacked an ash tree?
Yes. Actually, what we try to do is to tell people that there are insecticides that are available. We have a website, eabindiana.info.
Go ahead and give that to them again.
Okay, EAB, as in boy, eabindiana.info, okay, is the website. And on there, we have instructions on the kinds of pesticides that we can use to protect the trees. And what I like to think of it is as like a tidal wave of insects rolling over your neighborhood. And you can protect your trees under a protective bunker as that wave moves across. And it takes about 6 to 8 years for the entire wave to move through. In some parts of Indianapolis, I would say we are year 7 of that wave. So we maybe have one more year of protection. And then after that, when all the untreated trees are dead, you can ease back on the amount of protection because the clouds of beetles, the density just gets much, much lower. There's like an 80% decrease after the peak year. So you can just manage it by just using a small amount of insecticide. So we can keep trees alive.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about landscape insects. What are the good ones and what are the bad ones here on No Limits? If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. One more question on the emerald ash borer. Well, maybe more than that because I often say one more question. I find that your answer provides me with still more stuff I'm curious about. I want to know if after the emerald ash borer has attacked the tree, mm-hmm. is that basically fatal? Is there something to treat it? I understand that you can protect them through pesticides and all of that, but is there any hope for recovery?
Oh, yes. If you have 2/3 of the canopy intact, you can save it, okay, if the tree is worth saving. So in other words, the problem is that it's a borer, so it will kill certain limbs. So if you're starting to notice that some limbs are dying, you might want to have a professional arborist take a look at it to see if the tree that's left is worth saving. But technically, we can save it with there's some insecticide called triage that professionals can use, and they inject it once, and it lasts for 3 years.
triage, that's a clever play on words. Yeah. Very clever. I bet the boys in marketing just love that one. Joellen, what are some of the other insects that that gardeners have to watch out for, that they have to protect their gardens from?
A new one I think that's confounding a lot of us is the brown marmorated stink bug, which a lot of people are aware of now because they are leaving our houses and going outdoors. And unlike our native stink bugs, these guys like to eat all of our foods and vegetables and fruits, and they like to live with us because they seek that warmth that we have in our houses. And so in the mid-Atlantic states, for instance, people will have, like, their ceilings loaded with these brown marmorated stink bugs. And I don't know how many they predict are in Indiana right now, but they've been spotted here since, I think, 2012. Was the first time they were spotted here, and every year there have been more and more of them spotted. But they like apples, tomatoes, peppers, soybeans, sweet corn. I mean, they have a pretty voracious appetite.
A lot of the stuff we grow, too.
A lot of the stuff we grow. And unfortunately, they don't really go after our produce and fruit until right before it's ready to be harvested. And so there are limitations on pesticides that you can use when you're ready to harvest your food. If you read the labels, it'll sometimes say, you know, do not apply within 3 days of harvesting or within 2 weeks of harvesting or, you know, whatever the label says on that. And so frequently we'll have spoiled fruit and not be able to use what we've got. And unfortunately, the brown marmorated stink bug makes a lot of the foods unmarketable. So even though you might have apples that you can harvest, if they've been damaged by the brown marmorated stink bug, you can't make applesauce out of it or apple juice out of it. So it makes the food unmarketable, which is, you know, a terrible impact on not just the home gardener, but agriculture in general.
What brought them here? I mean, you said they're common for the mid-Atlantic states. I mean, is it similar to the emerald ash borer situation?
It is. Yeah.
Brought here? Go ahead, Joanna.
In Allentown, they showed up in Allentown, I want to say 2009. Does that sound?
I don't recall, but that sounds about right.
Yeah, and so they showed up in packing material is what people are suspecting that they did, and they are known hitchhikers. A couple years ago, I was doing a story for the Indianapolis Star, and I was interviewing a professor from Purdue, and he was at a gas station up in West Lafayette, and he said that there were just these brown marmorated stink bugs all along this pole in the gas station, and right next to one of the pumps was a car from Missouri, and he said there's no reason to think that that stink bug couldn't, like, hop on the car and end up in Missouri. They are just very good and adept at hitchhiking, which is primarily how they got spread around the country, unlike the emerald ash borer, which was brought in primarily by, like, firewood and things like that.
How do we get rid of them? I mean, I've got to admit, stink bugs just drive my wife crazy, and, you know, it seems like we're finding them in increasing numbers in the house, particularly now that we, you know, it's nice and we like to leave the windows open.
Right. They don't bite us, and they don't bite pets, so they're not going to, like, bite us. They're just a nuisance, and there's not a lot we can do except make sure that any ways they can get in the house are blocked, so we want to make sure we have good caulking around the windows, we don't have big open spaces. That's kind of, and, you know, have your own separate little vacuum to vacuum up the stink bugs, and they should have the kind of disposable bags in them so that you can take them outside. But that's what a lot of people do, is they'll suck them up in a vacuum and then take the bags outside.
And are there, once they are in the house, though, is there any hope that you're going to be able to shut them out? Because it sounds like, in some ways, you know, either of our kids could bring them in after they're riding on a bicycle or something like that if they jump under your closed cliff.
The thing is that they don't winter. I mean, they're not reproducing in your house.
Okay.
They just come in from the outside after they've been growing, and they're looking for a place to spend the winter. So the key time, you know, as Joellen was saying, is to keep them from getting in the house in the fall. But once they're in the house, okay, I heard of a new way to get rid of them. You can basically, you need a gooseneck lamp. Mm-hmm. And a bowl of soapy water, and you shine that gooseneck lamp onto that bowl of soapy water, and you turn out all the lights at night and leave that on, and they'll be accumulating.
And they'll swim to it,
or
fly to it.
They'll fly to it, and they can't swim.
Huh. Okay.
So they drown.
Yeah.
We say, I've heard that the people who have swimming pools are sort of the early warning systems of brown marmorated stink bugs because they'll find them in their pools because they can't swim. So that's just one of the ways, one of the early detection systems that we have.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about landscape insects, the good ones and the bad ones. We're talking about, so far we've been talking mostly about the bad ones and the damage they do, the annoyance they create. Pretty soon we're going to start talking about the economic impact because it sounds like it is significant. But if you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. That's a toll-free call. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Cliff Sadoff, who's a professor of entomology at Purdue University, and Joellen Meyer-Sharp, who is Indiana's gardening guru. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about landscape insects, the good and the bad. My guests are Cliff Sadoff, who's a professor of entomology at Purdue University, and Joellen Meyer-Sharp, who does everything gardening. She's a gardening author, garden magazine editor, and columnist. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Well, before we went to the break, we were talking primarily about two, the emerald ash borer and the stink bugs. And we've sort of established that, you know, they damage the aesthetic of neighborhoods by taking down trees. And they can be incredibly annoying by sort of invading your home. But we also established that in cases, I mean, it's costly to treat the trees, and they're actually at some level attacking the food supply. Do we have any idea what these two, is it fair to call them pests?
Yeah.
Pests, what these two pests cost us in terms of damage to either the food chain or trees, which, you know, obviously that has an environmental cycle implication.
Well, there's been some estimates that suggest that the emerald ash borer is likely to cost over $10 billion by 2019.
Here in Indiana or nationwide?
Nationwide. When you think about it, if it costs, you know, $500 to remove a tree, and you've got tens of thousands of trees, that the bill gets up pretty high when you start just the cost of removal. So it's quite expensive. So the numbers are in the billions of dollars, for sure.
And how about the cost for the stink bugs, particularly the damage they do to the agricultural supply line?
I couldn't find any specific figures on that. The last figure I saw was about $11 million to the apple crop, and that was primarily in the mid-Atlantic states. And since that study was done, you know, they've moved west. The bugs have moved west. And in Indiana, they've been found on soybeans and corn in two different parts of the county. In Elkhart County of the state, in Elkhart County, they were found on soybeans. In Clark County, they were found on sweet corn. And if they continue to proliferate, then we're going to have a serious ag problem, I think.
And I should have asked the same question. Is there anything, once they have gotten here, that we can do about them? I mean, you indicated, Joellen, that because they like to attack vegetables primarily, or I guess some fruit too, right as it's supposed to be harvested, you can't use the pesticides at that point without
poisoning. You're limited in the pesticides that you can use. The issue is that they're, it's not like you can spray something and have them walk across it and have them croak. Mm-hmm. That you have to actually hit the bug with the material that you're using, with the spray that you're using.
Oh, boy. So it's incredibly labor-intensive, too. You're going to have somebody marching through there.
And you have to be pretty vigilant about it. I mean, you know, because they can do a lot of damage very fast.
And, I mean, and as you were kind of saying that they'd been found in Elkhart County and Clark County, I mean, that's two different ends of the state.
Well, they're found here, too.
Yeah, okay. So I'm presuming that that means that the entire state has been attacked.
Yeah. They haven't been officially reported in every single county, but if you just take a look at a bird's eye view, they're everywhere.
And is there a hope, like you said with the Emerald Ash Borer Cliff, that that it's like a 6 to 8 year cycle? Yeah.
This is more like a 20-year cycle is what you're going to be thinking about.
So we could be doing this until 2030.
A lot of that is conjecture, and we don't have a 20-year
right.
history with this at this point in time. But in some of the states where it was first found, we're starting to see more of the native parasites attacking the eggs, and we're starting to see the beginnings of what could be a decline in the population there. And since they're about 10 years ahead of us, you know, it's going to be a difficult decade ahead for us.
Right, and we're lucky because they only have one life cycle, I think, here in the north, but in the south they can have two or three life cycles. So southern Indiana, for instance, may be more affected by more than one life cycle of this insect than we might be in Indianapolis. And with, you know, global warming, who knows, you know, how much farther north that will take the life cycles, because that would make it even more difficult to try to control and manage.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about landscape insects, the good, the bad, and I suppose the indifferent. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. I've gotten a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air. Who says folks want to do the right thing for the declining bee population, but we get mixed messages about buying the right plants. So, Joellen, I'll let you go.
Yeah, that is a dilemma for a lot of gardeners, because a lot of growers will treat their plants, especially ornamental plants, with a family of insecticides commonly referred to as neonics. That is a persistent insecticide, so it's systemic. It goes all the way through the plant, the leaves, the pollen, the nectar, the flower. And the concern has been that if bees feed on the nectar or use that pollen and take it back to their nest, that they could be contributing to the overall decline of bees. But I have to tell you, I mean, Cliff and I both have done a lot of research and reading on this, and there are no definitive answers on any of it. And I think one of the things that as gardeners we need to be concerned about is asking at our garden centers what products are being used on the plants that we're buying. If they say we're not doing anything, we get our plants from Brehab, which is a big wholesale grower here in Indianapolis. And I know that Brehab does not treat its plants with these neonics. But some of the suppliers in Ohio, which provide perennials and annuals for a lot of garden centers in Indianapolis, do use this insecticide, you know, as needed. It's not being just broadcast over everything. It sort of is an as-needed basis. So it's important, I think, for gardeners to ask to let the garden center people know that we're concerned about this. But it's, you know, there's nothing really definitive on what is happening to bees because of the neonics. It looks like it's a combination of other environmental factors, all sort of like that coming together.
Yeah, if you talk to bee specialists like Greg Hunt at Purdue, there are a lot of factors causing bee decline. One of is a varroa mite. There's a mite which gets into the which feeds on the pupae. There's a tracheal mite that actually gets into their lungs, makes it difficult for them to breathe, sort of like a chronic emphysema, things that really make them decline. Neonics are yet one of the many things that contribute to this, but they're not the primary factor. Greenhouse growers do have alternatives to these neonicotinoids, they are getting increased levels of adoption.
We've got one more question about bees. And I should say, if you want to send a question either by Facebook or Twitter, you can do so either at No Limits WFYI if you're doing it by Facebook, or Twitter at WFYI. It says, what should a homeowner do if a bee colony is found on his or her property and he or she doesn't want it there?
You can call a beekeeper. Seriously, the beekeepers are looking for queens.
Right, they are. I mean, a lot of times they'll come and move the hive for you. So, you know, I would go online and I would go to Google and I type in Indiana beekeepers or Indianapolis beekeepers, and that would be the resource that I would use.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about landscape insects. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Lori, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
I have a question regarding pill bugs. I've lost several plants, and when I go to remove them, I notice that the root system is gone, and they're almost always surrounded by pill bugs. I have read that pill bugs don't eat roots, but I'm wondering if they're not the cause, what the cause might be.
Thanks very much for the call and the question. We'll try to get you an answer, Lori.
Okay.
Thank you.
Pill bugs are decomposers. Okay, so they feed on rotten and rotting tissues. So my guess is that something else probably killed your plant, and these are feeding in the aftermath.
Now, sometimes people call them roly-polies. They look like little armadillos, and they curl up when you touch them. They're usually not considered a bad bug.
We've also gotten an email question from a listener named Kathy. If you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. And I'm going to struggle with this one, Kathy. She says, what about using I'm going to have to do this phonetically.
Oh, diatomaceous?
You got it. Thank you, Joelle. And earth to get rid of insects.
I think it is a popular product that can be used, especially for controlling slugs. A lot of times it'll be used to control slugs around hostas and things like that. I think it depends on what the diatomaceous earth comes from. I mean, because there's like a couple of different sources, and one is more effective than the other, and Cliff might be able to speak to that.
Yeah. I don't.
You don't know?
I don't know about that, but I do know diatomaceous earth works by scratching the surface of the cuticle.
Right.
And makes them dry out.
Right. So the slugs would crawl across it, it would slice and dice their bodies, and they would eventually curl up and die, dry up.
We are talking about landscape insects here on No Limits. Blaine, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I am going to be moving to Bloomington, Indiana next month, and I am interested in starting a garden of perennials, and I was wondering if you knew of any insects that are more attracted to perennials than annuals.
Thanks very much for the call, Blaine, and good luck with the move.
Right. Really, I would not make my perennial selection on what kind of bugs might visit those plants. That would be just me. I mean, there are some insects and diseases that are going to maybe attack those plants, but I think you're always pretty safe if you wanted to select native plants or cultivars or varieties of native plants. I mean, some native plants are more garden-worthy than others, and I would, you know, look for those at first, especially because they'll support the native insects and pollinators and bees that we have, because they're sort of hardwired to look for those plants. But I wouldn't really make that my decision on that, unless I were thinking, you know, I might not grow tea roses because of insect and disease problems on those particular plants or something like that.
Got a Facebook question from a listener named Bethany, and you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. She asks, is there anything that home gardeners can do in their backyard to promote native insect species?
Well, one of the things that I don't think people realize is sort of like say, if we go back to bees, bee behavior. There's a behavior called where bees will come out of the nest and they don't flit from flower to flower to flower, species to flower, species to flower, like a butterfly might float to a coneflower, to a sunflower, to a salvia, where bees come out and they will just visit all the salvias, and then they'll take their harvest back to their nest, and then they will come out and they'll visit all the coneflowers. And so one of the things that we can do as gardeners is we can plant our plants in clumps rather than just having onesies all over the yard. If we can plant them in numbers of 3 to 5, the bees don't have to work so hard to get what they actually need. We're flying, you know, from the coneflower from the front yard to the backyard. So planting in clumps would be the main thing that I would think you would want to do. And also, again, you know, looking at native plants, especially cultivars of native plants, because like I said, some native plants are more garden worthy than others. And so those would be the, because they're hardwired. So we know that, for instance, monarch butterflies are sort of hardwired to look for asters when they're migrating. And asters are a late blooming perennial. They're a native perennial. And so we'll often find monarchs visiting perennials in September when they're migrating. And so those kinds of things are what we can do.
Gotten an email question from a listener named Kenny, and if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Kenny says, it is frustrating that essentially all we are hearing from you is the story of the historical failures of stopping pests with chemicals. Isn't there any research going on regarding the natural predators against the pests you are describing? Just about every critter has an enemy predator that feeds on it. What about this, Cliff?
Okay.
That's in your ballpark.
Yeah, well, it turns out that most of the pests in North America are exotic. That means they were shipped here from another continent.
Okay. So we'd have to bring the predator in?
So we'd have to bring the predator in from there. And actually, I've been involved with a program with the USDA where we released three different species of parasitic wasps from Asia to come in and feed on emerald ash borer. So when we talk about pest control on the overall basis, it's a mosaic of different types of tools. We use chemicals when appropriate, when there's an immediate need, and we were using these biologicals for the long-term control. Turns out that when you release these natural enemies to control these pests in forests, it usually takes about 10 to 20 years for them to actually do the job.
And are there any, I should ask the other part of that, I mean, if you introduce the predator into this environment, yes, does that create any adverse effects as well?
That's an excellent question. Back in the good old days, you could bring anything you wanted to in a suitcase. Now you can't, for very good reasons. We had all these things had to be vetted. We have to go through an environmental impact statement. It's a very public process before we can even release parasite one. It takes years for us to do this.
I'd like to just, so for example, aphids, which is, I don't know if that's an exotic pest necessarily, but they're here. And they can be on almost any plants. They can be on the stems. They can be on the leaves. They can be on the flowers. They can be on the fruit. And, you know, the main thing to do is, you know, hit them with a strong spray from your hose. And what that does is it knocks them down to the ground, which then makes them available to the predatory insects that would feed on those aphids. You're not killing them. You're just knocking them off of the plant and providing sort of dinner for the native predatory insects that we have. The thing about it is that it takes patience. It takes a few days for the native predators to find out, oh my gosh, there are aphids on this tomato plant, and they need to be in a certain number in order to attract the predatory insects that are going to take care of them. So if nothing else, gardening teaches us patience, and we just sometimes need to wait a few days for nature to take its course.
Yeah, and on that too, if you use the water to knock off those aphids, there's no residue on there on those things, and that allows the parasites to attack the aphids and the ladybugs to attack the aphids without being killed by any residual pesticide.
Mm-hmm.
We are talking about landscape insects here on No Limits. We've got an email question from a listener named Chad. You can reach out to us by email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Chad says, great program as I listen online from Elkhart County. Glad to hear that, Chad. Thank you very much. How does one assist with the butterfly population, especially monarchs? I understand they are a threatened species. Can you elaborate more on encouraging more butterflies in landscape? Cliff, can we go your way? Or?
Okay. Yeah, you can. You want to plant their host plants, which means not the plant, the host for the adult, but the plant, the host for the caterpillar. So for monarchs, you want to plant plants in the milkweed family. For
swallowtails, it's in the carrot family.
Yep.
So parsley, dill, fennel. Well, you know, but the thing is everyone wants the butterflies, but they're all, oh my gosh, there's a caterpillar on my plant.
Right.
You know, they get wigged out by that, but that's the life cycle of that particular insect, and we have to be able to tolerate the caterpillars eating our plants as well as the butterflies visiting our plants and collecting nectar and pollen.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about landscape insects, the good, the bad, and the indifferent. here on No Limits. My guests are Cliff Sadoff, a professor of entomology at Purdue University, and Joellen Myers-Sharp, who is a Hoosier Garden author, Garden Magazine editor, and columnist. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about landscape insects, the good ones and the bad ones. My guests are Cliff Sadoff, who's a professor of entomology at Purdue University, and Joellen Myers-Sharp, who is a Hoosier Garden author, Garden Magazine editor, and columnist. Got a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air, who says, are armadillos in Indiana, is it true that they carry leprosy, which can be transmitted through soil?
Well, neither of us are animal people. But, yes, there are. I mean, the Department of Natural Resources has reported that there are armadillos in Indiana, in southern Indiana. And I know that in the past, historically, they are connected with the spread of leprosy. But what that role is now, I don't know.
So we've established, obviously, that this is a huge sort of concern. I don't think we can. Are there sort of places where people, and I might add, just in the conversation we've had so far, that these issues are a lot more complex than most people realize, that there is a balancing act that has to take place almost everywhere. Are there places that people can go to get more information, say, about the emerald ash borer or another other invasive insects?
Well, as a matter of fact, for emerald ash borer, this month we're having a series of town hall meetings in many counties throughout the state of Indiana, sponsored by extension educators. And down in Indianapolis, we're going to have a series of three, one on May 11th, 12th, and 13th at the Eagle Creek Park, Keep Indiana's Beautiful Office, and also at the fairgrounds. They'll be from 5:30 till 7:30.
Is there any cost to attending?
It's free. I'll be there talking about emerald ash borer. Bill Kinches, from the Department of Public Works, will be there, and so will Joe Jarzen from Keep Indianapolis Beautiful.
Okay. Are there sort of any rules of thumb that that people should use in terms of determining how to deal with an insect that they might be harmful, in determining whether it is being harmful to their vegetation? You know, Joellen pointed out in the last segment, people will freak out when they see a caterpillar and realize, okay, you get rid of that, you're also killing a butterfly, which
Want. Some caterpillars are worse than others. I mean, there's the cabbage worm, which can make little holes in your cabbage, and that. I think it's a matter of sort of training training ourselves in what we can accept in the garden. So we can accept maybe a little bit of damage by the tomato hornworm on our tomatoes, maybe the loss of a few leaves. But if it's like devouring the whole plant, then, you know, we might want to figure out something else to do. But it's just a matter, I think, of training the mind's eye to know, first of all, that Mother Nature is not perfect, that there are insects that might leave holes in the leaves or something like that, which is not detrimental to the plant. It's more of an aesthetic thing. And so I'm sort of a laissez-faire gardener. It has to be pretty bad for me to take any kind of action on anything, because I feel like if I can leave things alone enough, that Mother Nature will take care of most everything. There are a few things that I do worry about. For instance, I have an ash tree in my yard, which I do have treated. Because it's the biggest tree in my yard, it's the only shade tree I have, and so that's the one that, you know, gets some attention paid to it. So those are the kinds of decisions I think that we have to make as property owners or gardeners or homeowners. So we have to develop some tolerance for some damage and, you know, just make the decision on, okay, this is too much.
If you are just joining us, we're talking about landscape insects here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Great show today.
Thank you.
Had a question regarding dragonflies. My property borders a small lake, and dragonflies are very much a part of the ecosystem there. And I was just curious, what could I do to attract more? Because I think they're very interesting. And also, what purpose or what's their role within the ecosystem?
Thanks very much for the call and the questions, Chris.
Okay, well, actually, dragonflies spend most of their life underwater, okay, which is why you have them near your pond. And they are predators. So they will feed on other smaller insects. They might feed on, sometimes that might include mosquito larvae and things along those lines as well. So so probably not disturbing your pond is probably the best thing that you can do. And being careful about any insecticide use that you use to make sure it doesn't trickle in there.
We had a caller who didn't want to go on the air. Who said, is there a bug that will kill dandelions or weeds?
Oh, the biological control of weeds.
Okay. Yes.
There are so many different kinds of weeds that that's an impossible question to answer. Fortunately, there's not one bug that eats all the weeds, because if it did, they would eat all the plants we wanted all at the same time. But one of the things you can do in your lawn to discourage weeds is to mow higher.
Right. And have a good, have a healthy lawn. That's the... Weeds are opportunistic, so if there's a little bit of a space in your lawn, the weed seeds are going to go in there and germinate, and you're going to get weeds. So the healthier your lawn is, mowing high, not over-fertilizing, I think, aerating once a year, usually in September. The main thing is to keep your lawn healthy. That's the best defense you can have against keeping the weeds out.
Gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Wendy, and if you want to reach out to us on Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. Wendy says, this should be the year my strawberries will have fruit as I planted them last year. They are blooming white flowers. Is there any insect that will cause them harm? If so, what should I do? I really like to be organic.
I've been having strawberries in my own garden, and I've never used any insecticides on them, and I get enough that I can eat them. And if that's good enough for you, then you'll probably be fine. And this goes just back to what Joellen said. You have to remember your strawberry patch is not the strawberry stand in the grocery store. It's where you harvest strawberries as they're ready. Some might be eaten by something. They might get a little bit of mold on them. And you just take the best ones, and that's what you use.
Gotten an email from a listener named Deb who says, please clarify that there are numerous kinds of bees. You mentioned mm-hmm. calling a beekeeper to move a hive you don't want, but beekeepers would not be interested in carpenter bees or other such bees, only honeybees, and you are not likely to find honeybees building a hive in your yard.
Okay, there are many different types of bees. Honeybees are the ones that we're familiar with. These are the ones that beekeepers have in these white boxes, and they move them around. They're in the native habitat, they would be inside trees where they would grow these things. Then there are also many, many solitary bees, carpenter bees, mason bees. These bees are excellent pollinators, and they're actually a little bit more sensitive to these neonicotinoids than, say, the honeybees as well.
I'm trying. We're getting a lot of these backed up, so I'm going to try to march through them pretty quickly.
Okay.
And that's also with our callers, if you can keep your questions tight, because we will be staying on time. I've gotten an email from a listener named Rose saying, I have several very large ant nests in the lawn. Are they harmful? Should I do anything about them, Cliff?
Okay, those are Allegheny mound ants, and they come up, they're sort of boiling up. You see them this time of year. You can control them with an application of a pyrethroid insecticide. If you Google Purdue ant control, you will see recommendations.
Okay. And then we had a question from another caller who did not want to go on the air. It says, has a lot of boxwood planted around her house and wants to know if she should look for any specific helper bugs.
Helper bugs?
Helper bugs.
There's two pests that are really active right now. One is actually the boxwood psyllid, which you'll see this little waxy stuff in the leaf, in the tips. It'll be covered, and then another one might be a boxwood leaf miner, which will cause little blisters in the leaf. In terms of helper bugs, nothing really comes to my mind.
Yeah.
If you are just joining us, we're talking about landscape insects, the good and the bad. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Norm, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello, Norm. What's on your mind?
I have some hickory porch rockers, and they have a dust that keeps coming out of them. I was told it was hickory boring beetles, and I was wondering how's the best way to get rid of those.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call and the question, Norm. Cliff?
Okay. I'm not sure of the species, but there are many beetles that feed on lumber. So it's a matter of keeping your chairs dry when possible. So you might want to store these things there in the wintertime. Also, you can apply painting it works pretty well, so that keeps it less attractive to those beetles. And then you may also, if you follow the label directions, maybe apply an insecticide on them.
Got a caller who did not want to go on the air who says, are there any plants that will help? I'm in favor of this one. Are there any plants that will help repel mosquitoes?
Well, a lot of people think lemongrass and citronella geraniums will do the trick. But honestly, I don't know of any research that would confirm that.
Yeah. They're attracted to carbon dioxide. So the hotter and sweater you get, the more you're going to get. So wear long sleeve shirts, wear white shirts. Dark clothing does attract them as well.
So there really is nothing, no vegetation.
Less vegetation is better.
Yeah.
Less vegetation, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which is not really good news for gardeners then.
Yeah, shorter.
But you just don't want to put your lawn chairs in the middle of the grass or in the middle of your garden, have them be sort of offset a little bit.
And are there, I know obviously from travels, there are natural predators for mosquitoes, right? Bats
and they're predatory mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm.
They're like tree-hole mosquitoes, which will feed on
the other mosquitoes.
Other mosquitoes, yeah.
But they won't feed necessarily on us the way mosquitoes do.
Some do, some don't. It's a big question.
What is the biggest misperception about these sort of pests? I mean, I know that's a broad cat.
The biggest misperception is that there's a silver bullet that will take mm-hmm. care of it all. And that everything is, that one, an insect is either all bad or all good.
Right.
Well, make a case, though, for the emerald ash borer being good.
Again, that's an exotic pest.
Yeah. Okay.
So if it was in Asia, it would have a natural predator that would take care of it. Yeah. It's just we're trying to get our predators to recognize it as a possible food source, which, takes time.
But in some sense, though, it's a predator, too, and it's attacking our trees, right?
Well, borers are decomposers, okay? And they take trees and turn it to sawdust, which eventually becomes soil, all right? And so in the ecosystem in Asia where it's from, they're part of that whole mix. In North America, we have the bronze birch borer, which is a kissing cousin to the emerald ash borer, and it feeds on birch trees. And so river birch do quite well, and the ones that get old, these are involved in killing the older ones and causing them to turn back into soil.
But is there, for example, the other bug we've talked about quite a bit, the stink bug, is there any ecological value to that creature, or
we're hoping it'll be a good source for birds. That's what I'm hoping.
Oh, that it will feed birds.
Yeah,
but
that's beyond, my hope.
beyond that, but absent that, does it perform any beneficial role in terms of?
You have to think of this in terms ecologically, in terms of food webs.
Right.
Okay. So imagine a web with every single node. One insect feeds another on another kind of insect. They go up and down and across the trophic levels, and that diversity of relationships is what enhances stability. So that if one node drops out, the entire web doesn't come crashing down.
We are talking about landscape insects here on No Limits. Doug, welcome to the program.
How are you?
Doing fine. What's on your mind?
I am a professional lawn care professional, and I just wanted to let people know that it is cheaper to pre-treat for grubs than to fix the damage that they've caused as far as dollar to dollar. It's cheaper to get the pre-treatment than to fix the lawn, because normally what that means is bringing machines out, tilling the soil, replanting the grass seed, etc., let alone the unsightly
side of dead grass in your lawn.
Thanks very much for the call and the comment, Joellen.
I know that there are products out there that are preventative or prophylactic when it comes to grubs. I'm of the opinion that if you don't have them, you shouldn't use the product. Or if you have them only in one part of your yard, just treat the one part of your yard. And if you've treated it one year, you may not have to treat it another year. And so I'm much more of a, don't do anything unless you know what you've got kind of a person, rather than just trying to generally broadcast some kind of a herbicide or insecticide or fungicide if you don't know that you have a problem.
Right. And there there's research that's going on that talks about sampling for grubs. In golf courses, there are ways of sampling parts of it to determine whether or not you need more for need to use an insecticide. Also, if you're going to use an insecticide, try not to use the neonicotinoids. There are some compounds that are actually relatively safe for bees, and if you're going to be using insecticides, make sure you include a weed control as well, so that you're not attracting bees to tainted weeds that'll kill them.
Gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Catherine. If you'd like to reach out to us by Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. Catherine says, we have borer bees attacking our deck. Any way to divert them to something tastier?
Ooh, well, like Joellen said, if it's raw wood, that's the problem. You really want to paint them, paint the wood. They are less attracted to painted wood surfaces than raw. Exposed.
It is a solitary insect bee. Mm-hmm. It doesn't create a hive. It just wants to drill in, and it'll come back year after year to the same place, too. So plugging up the holes, painting the wood, those would be two suggestions.
But there's no way, after it's found a home, I think in Catherine's question here is, you couldn't set up a pile of wood or something like that elsewhere that
put
might
little
take
directional it. Signs. I don't know.
That's a hypothesis worth testing. But
yeah.
It
is. Yeah.
Tell her to let us know how that works out.
Okay. All right. Well, Catherine, you've got an open invitation to get back with us on that. Okay. So if we are out there and we're attempting to have one takeaway from this conversation about how to deal with pests, what would it be? Silence is bad on radio.
Well, no,
folks.
I would say, going back to gardening teaches us patience. That if we can employ the patience we need to let Mother Nature take care of the problems that we have. The other thing would be to know what you have, identify what you have before using anything. I work at a garden center. People come in and tell me that they've sprayed an insecticide on this plant, and I look at the plant and I see it's a fungus. It's a disease and not a bug.
And we've got a series of apps at PurduePlantDoctor.com, a series of
go
apps.
Go ahead and give them that again.
PurduePlantDoctor.com. We have a series of apps that goes on your iPhone or your Android that helps you identify your pest problems on your flowers, perennials, trees, and your tomatoes.
That will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank Joellen and Cliff both for an enlightening conversation. Thank all of our listeners, including the ones whose questions and comments we could not get to. I hope you all have a wonderful weekend in which your paths are only crossed by the good bugs. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
A production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.